We will also be taping the lightning sessions on Thursday. All right, our next speaker, Dean Leffingwell, will also be in the expo reception tonight. We have copies of his book free for all of the attendees, and Dean will sign a number of them before his arm falls off. Okay? And there he is. Yeah, right there. Right. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay. Good.
Thanks. I'm Dean Leffingwell. There will be no code cut during the course of this presentation. There will not be a single virtual machine that gets created. And I'm wondering if Jason goes away now and kills all of those apps that he built, or if Azure is slowly grinding to a halt with every demo that he does. What do you think? Does he have a macro that he uses to eliminate that stuff, or what? I'm going to talk about something entirely different, unrelated at all to what you learned about this morning. I'm going to talk about really one topic disguised as three. First topic is to be agile. Lots of Scrum.org people here and Scrum Alliance people here. I suspect you already are. I heard Jason say every 3 weeks they push software. Sounds like a three-week sprint, Jason. Most sprints are 2 weeks now. I wonder why so slow. Maybe we ought to get on with the program a little bit and put some pressure on that. And then we're going to talk about how to scale up, because that's what I do. I've been involved in large systems development pretty much throughout my career. For a while on my website, I had the bio at 3 decades of experience in software development. In August, I woke up and said, you know, it's time to fess up. I'm at 4 decades of experience in software development now. So hopefully I've learned a few things. Hopefully I didn't learn the same thing more than a couple times. But what I've been doing is helping large enterprises, name brand enterprises, enterprises that have the challenge of, oh, in one case, there's 1,000 practitioners, developers, and testers contributing to a single code line. Not your best first assignment. But as you scale up, how do we avoid basically killing the goose at laying the golden egg? How do we take that energy and that empowerment and indeed that kind of team level entrepreneurial spirit, scale it and keep the whole enterprise lean? And that's going to be kind of the third part of the topic. First, my background. I've been here before, but I was with Rational at the time. I was with Rational Software. I was responsible for the Rational Unified Process, Requisite Pro, ClearQuest, not so much ClearCase, and a few other things, and Rational University, our education and training thing, which is I'm still kind of involved in today from a slightly different standpoint. When I got to Rational, Objectory, which was our software process, was a $10,000 per seat consultative sale. One of the things I think that we did fairly cleverly was we put it on a CD and sold it for $695. And some few million copies later, the Rational Unified Process is out there in much use today. And it's still in use today. And I talk to enterprises all the time using RUP fairly successfully. They're difficult for me to go in as kind of a tipping agent, but for a couple of reasons. Number one, they remember me. And they say, well, you're talking about different stuff now. And I say, yeah, but I've learned some things over the last few years. And when I learn things, I change my opinion. And number two, the RUP shops, they do better. They do better than the traditional shops do. I became enamored with Agile kind of in the late 90s, but in the early 2000s, 2002 and 2003. I was actually working with one of these startup companies out here, Rally Software. They're in the lifecycle management business, too, the application lifecycle management business. And I met a guy there by the name of Dave Muirhead, really a brilliant guy, one of the quintessential, so brilliant he was hard to work with, and he taught me XP. And I'd been away from coding for a while, and I was incredibly impressed by the discipline with which he approached code. And that was really refreshing for me, because RUP was a serious process. Talked most about roles and activities and artifacts, but it wasn't really a kind of a code-oriented process. So I became convinced that this was a better thing than the things I'd been talking about before, and kind of moved down that path. I ended up then doing some writing. I'm compelled to write down the things that I learn. I'm not sure why. It's some kind of a DNA defect. I write to think. When I write something and I read it and it talks back to me, I feel like I understand it. So I've been writing books for pretty much throughout my career, starting with some traditional stuff, managing software requirements, a unified approach. I'd strongly recommend that you not buy and read that book, okay? That's where my thinking was in about 1995, but we moved on from there. In 2007, I wrote Scaling Software Agility. Still a solid book. It has some stuff now. I'd like to refactor it, but it's kind of too late for that. And most recently, the book I'll be signing today is Agile Software Requirements. It's the book is really about software requirements, and it really is about Agile Software Requirements, and it's about Lean, but it's kind of badly named because it's really the effective application of Lean and Agile development at scale from a requirements perspective. Why from a requirements perspective? Well, that's all we get is intangible stuff, right? What the customer wants to do is just kind of a statement of work. The title isn't the perfect title. I thought about some others. I was going to write Scaling Software Agility Now Really Working, but my editor didn't think that was a good plan, so it's called Agile Software Requirements. But much of what you see here comes from there. But I wrote that book in 2010, published it in 2011. I continue to learn. I continue to kind of practice my lean skills, working with some of the real experts in the area, and that's helped me a lot. My current mantra, I started companies, so for the first 30 years ago, I was responsible for shipping software. I no longer am. I build a website. My current mantra is no employees, no directors, no shareholders. I'll do about anything that doesn't involve one of those three. So I'm independent, my current project is a thing called the Scaled Agile Framework. Now, this is a test, and I'm prepared to be embarrassed. How many of you been to or have seen the Scaled Agile Framework? Not bad, a 5%, 6% market share. Last session, I was at about 4 months, there were three people. This is a free public-facing website. We and some other people, people that you probably hang around with or know, people like Alan Shalloway and some of these other guys here, have made a commitment to take our intellectual property, the stuff that we think helps people write software better, and simply make it public. We're doing it because we can and because we want to, and frankly, because the benefits of enhanced software development productivity aren't just cooler stuff for the users. Teams like it better. You've all been in the trenches for a while. You know what it's like for a traditional software project where you work yourself really, really hard. You do your best. The system is potentially flawed. Maybe you've got bureaucratic overhead. Maybe you've got legacy code you can't get into. Maybe you've got role-based specializations where you can't even stand up a virtual machine or configure a database schema. For whatever reason, it can be really hard. And you can do really good work and not have a really, really great result, right? Defect triage, 2, 3, or 4 months. Well, that's offensive to me after 40 years of this, and I just think we can do better. And as we learn how to do better, I like to write about how people are doing better. So the Scaled Agile Framework is accessible. Four core values: alignment amongst teams, code quality matters, you can't scale crap. Nothing we do in some of these larger enterprises to try to scale agile development works if we're scaling crappy code. It's an exponential problem. The stuff gets worse and worse and worse, right? One small misassumption, one small defect, one small malformed table, one small user error not detected, and pretty soon you got this nightmare. So code matters. Code quality matters. And I like hanging around here where you actually can code during the presentations because you have wireless data access and power as well. Program execution matters, right? We work at the program level. I'm a huge fan of Scrum. You'll hear that today. I didn't invent it. I didn't have anything to do with it, but I really, really like it. But it's about the team. And while the software starts with the teams, at the program level is where the impact really has to happen. And then lastly, transparency. Okay? Why doesn't that say trust, right? All of Agile development, Agile is really hard, frankly. I tell enterprises when we go in for a transformation, I say, this will be the hardest thing you've ever done. And we're dependent upon trust. Well, I can't ensure trust. The company may or may not have it. They may not trust you, or your customers may not trust you, or your dealers or distributors or partners may not trust you. So I can't make that happen for you. But what I can help do is to find a system that has transparency, because transparency breeds trust. So throughout the model that you'll see here today, we're going to talk about transparency as a key value for doing software development at scale. If we can align our teams, have really good code quality, right? Learn how to execute larger scale programs in an agile fashion and have transparency throughout. Some fairly good things have to happen. So here are some of my buddies. I won't go much further there. The real contributors are these enterprise adopters up here, the folks like you, although I can't speak to you specifically because I have no knowledge of my work being applied here, and the companies that we've learned from. Now, let me tell you how a consultant's life works if they're on the game. A consultant has to know something. It doesn't have to be very many things. They have to know one thing suitable for somebody to hire them to tell them about. So maybe I knew one thing once, and I got invited in to talk about that one thing. But while I'm there, I'm asking this enterprise, well, how are things working here? Well, everybody has their problems, right? You got problems in software development here? How many people have problems in software development? Well, ta-da, right? Okay. We have problems in software development in the single most successful companies in the history of our industry. I think that's fantastic. But how many here in your organization can think of some things that you're doing really well? All right, right, okay. So here's what I do as a consultant. Who has a problem? Raise your hand. You have a problem. Tell me what your problem is. I might have an idea. You feel pretty good about that. Who's doing something really well? Raise your hand. I'm all ears. Tell me what's working. So the Scaled Agile Framework is an aggregation, right? It's a compilation of the things that we've observed work. Occasionally we had an insight or whatever, but that's not really important. What's important is that the stuff works. Now, a few years ago, I was faced with a challenge to go to a large enterprise and to tip their PMO to Agile. Can anybody guess how many people were in the PMO of this enterprise? Pretty big enterprise. I won't tell you how many in the enterprise. How many were in the office of the PMO?
Too many.
I love working with developers still. I just do. That's good. I like that. Who said that? Okay. I got you. I've got you in my sights now. 300 people, right? And we had rolled, and by the way, this was a highly successful enterprise too, shipping mobile devices by the millions, sometimes a half a million or a million a day. The organization was functionally organized, meaning that they had development and they had tests and they had the project office and they had product and program management and they had all these great silos. Nothing went through that organization unless some PMO person moved all the value through sideways. So I have a great respect for those people because they're basically making my non-functional organization work. But when I went there a few years ago, I realized I have nothing for them. They don't care about Scrum and the Dilbert cartoons and Agile and XP, and the teams are empowered or they don't give a hoot, right? This is not their bailiwick, but they understand lean thinking, and so did I, because I was fortunate. I had a manufacturing operation back in the 80s, back in my kind of second decade, and we had to run a lean shop because we didn't have any choice, otherwise we were dying on the vine. So lean thinking is different. Lean thinking gives us a mindset and a much broader set of principles we need to succeed, and it's a pretty broad set. Okay? And everybody has their paradigms. Lean has their house of lean. I once got in a fight. I won't tell you who the argument was with because he's a famous guy, a lean thinker. And he goes, Dean, you don't understand the five principles of lean, you idiot, you. And there's or the three columns, or the five principles and the three columns. I said, oh, I felt pretty bad about that. So I went away and started studying house of leans. And there's always three or four columns, and there's always five principles, but they're always different. So you kind of get to pick the ones that you want. Well, here's the ones that I picked, also with some support from others like Craig Larman and Boss Vody, also authors in this field. People have done a great job of bringing lean thinking to software development. So here we go. The goal, respect for people, product development flow, Kaizen, and leadership foundation. And we'll come back to that in a second. What's the goal of Agile? Somebody shout it out. Some Agile people here, right? I'm in the right place? Why are you doing Agile? Faster feedback and better decisions. Very good. Why are you doing Agile?
Bring value
to the customer. Good. Another. Somebody else.
Build software.
Pardon?
Build software.
To build software. Okay. So there's lots of opinions and versions of why we're doing Agile, but there's only one definition of why you're doing Lean. Right? And that definition is right here. The sustainably shortest lean time. Now, if I approach that PMO with that simple mantra, I said, this is why I'm here. There are other things in our bag of tricks, et cetera, but what we're looking for is a sustainably shortest lead time, best quality and value to people and society, most customer delight, lowest cost, high morale and safety. Now, these are some kind of Toyota production system kind of Japanese converted to English grammars, but you get the idea. And Lean can be very simple, right? Taichi Ono, the godfather of Lean, certainly the godfather of Kanban, said, I looked in one of his books, all we're doing is looking at the timeline. from the moment the customer gives us an order to the point where we collect the cash, and we're reducing the timeline by reducing the non-value-added waste. Very simple statement. Mary Poppendieck said it even simpler. We need to figure out a way to deliver software so fast our customers won't have time to change their minds. And I think, and I was at a presentation of Alan Shalloway's the other day, and he mentioned something in passing that I just thought was brilliant. And he was using kind of Kanban to describe the way a software process works. And he says, I posit that whatever's wrong with your software will introduce a delay. So if you want to understand what's going on with your software, understand the delays and work backwards. And that's kind of quintessentially lean thinking as well. Not every environment where we find lots of developers has a tremendous respect for their people. And that's painful, because it's painful just from a sociological aspect, from an HR aspect. It's also painful from the standpoint of results. So I went into one organization that didn't have a very solid culture. They had about 1,000 devs, mostly Java shop, pretty much throughout. And they were run by people that had come up through kind of the legal and purchasing. So the new CEO was a lawyer, et cetera, but they fundamentally didn't understand software, and the culture wasn't very conducive to effective software development. So I went on, I don't code anymore. I just don't. I just don't have the patience for it. I don't know, maybe I lost that over time. I'm not sure why. But so I went on the web and just clipped a bunch of Java code together, random Java, just Java apps, and snipped it together and put this company's header in the front and made a little 5-page program. So my first slides where I went click, 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 and I said, can anybody here read this stuff? I was in front of the entire executive team. There were 15 people there. Now, that wouldn't happen here, I'll tell you. But what happened there was, well, no, nobody could read it. And they all looked to the VP, the SVP of development, said, can you read this stuff? And he said, no, that language came after my time. And I made a kind of a pithy point. I said, don't you think it's going to be important to be really nice to the people that know how to do that, right? Isn't that really what we want to create? We want to create an environment where they want to do their best work and deliver code. So respect for people is quintessentially lean. Kaizen, or continuous improvement. I don't like continuous improvement so much, because it's been used a lot, and it has this passive thing, continuously improve. Well, who here isn't continuously improving? We all are. Kaizen means a little different. We can do better, right? We can do better. What we just delivered was our best yet. We can do better. And that mindset is a quintessential part of lean as well. It's built into Scrum, right? Scrum retrospective, inspect and adapt cycles. It's built right in. It's programmatically. I'll show you a little bit in a second how Scrum really addresses a lot of these principles head on. And then to get a little deeper, now the problem with what I've talked about so far is it's kind of mom and apple pie stuff you could recognize. You don't really know what to do about it, other than hopefully take some of our policies and philosophies a little more seriously. But in the house of lean is the guts, the things that you do to run a lean shop. In our case, the things that you do to run a lean software shop, a lean software enterprise. And for there, I refer to my hero, who is Don Reinertsen. And he has a book here called Principles of Product Development Flow. I'm an avid reader. I think I read most good stuff on software. This is the best book I've read in the last decade about software development. It's not about software development. It's about product development flow. So before you pick up a free copy of my book tonight, and I can only say this because they already bought my books, right? Order Reinertsen and read that book. And if you're serious, if you're deadly serious, if you want to know what principles you need to make things go faster to your customer, how to reduce batch sizes and shorten the queue lengths and get faster feedback, this is the book for you. Now, I'm going to only take you through a couple of these. It takes about a half day to really kind of walk through Reinertsen, but there's a few things here that might strike you funny. Take an economic view. Understand the economics of the decisions you're making. His example is from building the 777 airplane, where a mechanical engineer or electrical engineer had a trade-off sheet that said, I can trade this much time for this much weight, and this much weight for this much cost. And within those trade-offs, I'm free to make my own local decisions, local decision-making. You see others here: reduce batch sizes, apply WIP constraints, control flow under uncertainty with cadence and synchronization, get feedback as fast as possible. Somebody said over here that was their definition of agile, is how quickly they can get feedback. And lastly, decentralized control. This is a book about lean. Why is there this chapter on management of decentralizing control? Why do you decentralize control if you want to stay lean? Help me out. Somebody shout out an answer.
Quicker decision making.
Right? Quicker decision making. So if you want to stay lean and get things done faster, you've got to empower local decision making. So lean fundamentally cannot support a large-scale, hierarchical, top-down decision-making culture because it isn't lean. It isn't fast. So it's another kind of a great way to approach it on the side. And one quote here, which I just stuck in this morning because I realize it's on the website and it's one of my favorites, is a quote from writers, "In today's development processes typically deliver information asynchronously in large batches." You probably don't practice it, but you're aware of the waterfall model of development, right? Asynchronously in large batches, right? Sometime later, a great big blob, rather than here's a little bitty bite right now to take a piece of. Flow-based processes don't do that. Now, he's talking about manufacturing paradigms and applying it to R&D. Flow-based processes deliver information in a regular cadence in small batches. Cadence lowers transaction costs and makes small batches more economically feasible. Right? So cadence and synchronization are words that we're going to use as we scale. And this is kind of too deep for this audience, but the important chart is the one in the corner over here, which basically says as follows. If you have a system that's heavily loaded, in other words, the workers are busy, the systems are busy, the servers are busy, the painting robots are busy or whatever, and you send in a large batch, you have programmed an outcome that is highly variable, just like the freeway, right? When you go out on the freeway, if the freeway is running at full utilization and you send in a large batch, you get a reduction in output. But do you get a proportional reduction in output on the freeway when you send a large batch into a busy freeway? Does it just average the existing batch and the new batch? What happens? You get a catastrophic reduction in flow. So if systems are highly utilized and you send in big batch sizes, project slippage is the inevitable result. So if you're involved in a software project right now where everybody is fully utilized, there's a really, really big backlog being pushed through the system simultaneously and in parallel, you are guaranteed a highly variable result. Not because you're bad or stupid, but because the system that you've designed or has been designed for you isn't designed to run small batches through efficiently, and it can be. So we want to get small batches through the system much more quickly. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 1 week, whatever it takes. So let's be agile. Well, be agile is mostly at the team level of the Scaled Agile framework, and there we see the kind of scrum-like teams, and maybe I'll just kind of jump forward to the next slide and talk about the way that those teams need to cooperate. So what's an agile team do? They're empowered, self-organizing, and self-managing, and we mean it. They're not just words. There are no managers on a scrum team. Why not? I like managers, by the way. I work with them all the time. Why aren't they on a scrum team? Self-managing. I'm your manager, and they self-manage, and they know that I can wear two hats, and they treat me as an equal, and that's all fine. And then you go talk to the guy who had a great design that the manager smashed, and he says, "Well, how'd that go?" And he says, "Well, he thinks we're all equal, but the reality is, if I push forward with my design idea one more notch, it's going to come up in my employee review that I wasn't being supportive." So it doesn't really work, right? Self-organizing, self-managing, empowered, and we mean it. They have developers and testing, content authority, however you title that. Typically, that's a product owner in the Scrum role, content authority. Somebody who can make decisions for the team. This is a decentralization of control. All of a sudden, the control for the decisions of the team moves locally. Teams deliver valuable tested software increments every 2 weeks, right? Valuable and evaluatable. Teams apply Scrum and maybe Kanban, project management, and XP technical practices, we hope. People apply XP technical practices here? Raise your hand. How many do? How many don't? Okay. You have another 20 to 40 to 50% productivity and quality gain if you crack open the old XP books, read what Kent Beck said, distill what it means to you, and apply it, as we'll see in a second. Okay? Teams operate under program vision, system architecture, and UX guidance. This ship has to go someplace. We're going together to this destination. Our user's experience has to be fairly similar, no matter which team he got that that piece of code from. Architectural guidance matters. We'll talk about intentional architecture and emergent design a little bit further on. But we're lucky, right, from a lean standpoint, because we got two things. I know you got one. You may need the other one as well. We have Scrum, which is founded on lean. Just a few key items here. Cross-functional teams in Scrum, right? Developers, testers, product owners. How is that a lean concept? Everything comes together. It's a cooperative environment. It's like a manufacturing cell where multiple people can do different things. A tester can run a script. A developer can write a script. A product owner can elaborate a story. A tester can elaborate a story. A developer can elaborate a story or run a test script. Right? Cross-functional teams are more efficient and they help eliminate bottlenecks. Time boxes limit work in process. You can't do everything in 2 weeks. So all of a sudden people get real realistic about what you can do. Sprints provide fast feedback. 2-week sprints provide very fast feedback. Empowered local decision making. Co-location reduces. So co-location is a key element of lean, built right into Scrum. Co-location reduces back size and communication overhead. How does it do that? How does it reduce a batch size of a blob of communications? How does co-location do that? Smaller pieces. I need to talk to you about 4 or 5 things. You're right there. I've got my 4 or 5 things. Let's have that discussion. You're in building 17. Now, in order for me to go talk to you, I have to get a bigger batch of stuff to make it efficient. I have to walk to building 17 or ride my scooter, right? I have to have a much bigger batch of stuff to go talk to you about. So all of a sudden, because I'm not close, my batch size goes up. And small batches go through the system badly. If you talk to Kent Beck about lean, he'll say he didn't design XP to be lean because he believes lean was kind of the Toyota production system, reduction of waste and scrap, type 1, type 2 MUDA, that's a word for scrap, et cetera. He said that's not what we did. But it is what he did. He just didn't use those words to do it. TDD and ATD limit waste and scrap. All right, you don't go very far down the road without an understanding of detailed requirements at the point of attack. Very small batch sizes, right? Single story, single piece flow, fast feedback, test first, continuous integration, test automation, collective ownership, quintessentially lean things built right into XP. So good news in terms of scaling Agile. We don't have to retrain the teams, but we have to do more than be effective project managers, which is what Scrum brings us. We have to be effective coders as well. Lean is keen on work in process constraints for many reasons, right? When we force capacity matching to input, or we force input to match capacity, we get into flow. And we get into flow, we don't have overloaded systems where people are multiplexing across too many things. When we get into flow, teams can pull the next thing down the pipe and there's less communication required. Time boxes prevent uncontrolled expansion of work and they make waiting times predictable. So this thing that Jason talked about isn't in my next 3-week sprint. It's really, really important, Jason. You could have it in the next one after that. Now I'm a patient person. It didn't make this 3-week sprint, but it's going to make the next 3-week sprint. If he's not sprinting and I want a new thing, what do I do? There are no sprints and I want something new from Jason's teams. I say, do this. But there's no limit to what I want. So I just pile on. And if things start coming out late, what do? We work harder. And no, if John Deere is a good case study for Scaled Agile Framework, by the way, they adopted it and they're lean thinkers. If they're having trouble getting combines or tractors out of the plant in Waterloo, Iowa, right? If they're a little slow on their deliveries, do you think they're tempted to go put more parts on the floor? Just the opposite, right? They'll start stripping stuff out. They'll go get some of the work in process and move it to a lower cost holding area or whatever, and they'll lean the thing out because the stuff isn't moving. What happens when our software projects are late? Do we put more work on the floor? Absolutely. It's a natural thing to do. So our behavior is backwards. The later we are, the more we add. Time boxes prevent that. Make WIP continuously visible. Understand and take action. So let me give you a simple test here. You can all do this now because you're good scrummers or agile guys. How well is this team doing? on their sprint. It's a 2-week sprint. Who can tell me? Who's gonna tell me if they make it or not? They're in trouble. So that was about 16 seconds. Y'all agree they're in trouble? Took you 20 seconds to figure out this team, if you never heard of, is in trouble. Now, when I got to that team, they had that board, but it was a little behind, and they didn't have the dates on the top. They didn't have Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and they didn't have the rope. So I went and fired up the printer and made the dates, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and the rope is today, and we didn't have a rope, so I asked the teams, and I found a set of headphones that were broken. So we literally took a nail and a set of headphones, and we nailed it up on Thursday, and we said Wednesday, and we said, look, guys, we're behind. Okay. So what you can't see hurts you, right? And we don't get to see our stuff because it's all intangible. At least in Waterloo, you can see the dang thing. You can see how many cabs are in front of the paint booth, or how many raw weldments are in front of the welding robot. We can't see any of our stuff. It hurts us because we can't see it. It backs up. It creates a huge backlog. Now I have a question. Think amongst yourself for a second. So let's say that. So this was a serious issue for this company. I was brought in by their investors, who were friends of mine, to say, can we help them? And for a day or so, they thought I was Mean Dean. And Mean Dean said, look, I tell you what, let's establish a work in process limit here. From now on, no more than 3 stories in development or test, period, end of story. Now let's take a half a minute, maybe a minute, and talk amongst yourself and say, what changes when I do that? Have a short discussion. It's okay. I'll be back. I won't leave you. If I just said this is the new rule, no more than 3 stories in development and test, what's going to happen? Okay, here's the use case. I'm a developer. I just finished story 6. It awaits test. In the absence of a work in process limit, what is my natural behavior? Go get a new story. Once a work in process limit is in place, what is my natural behavior? Go be a tester. Right? Work in process limits change behavior. They cause everybody to work against the same objective, which is how many stories. There's 3 days left in the sprint, and only one story has been accepted by the product owner. Now, do you think they landed the sprint? They did. Who said that? How'd they do it? They worked all evenings and weekends, and they came in Tuesday morning, burnt and fried as hell, having pulled off that last sprint. Okay? What's our motivation next day for the next sprint? So they made the sprint, but they lost the war. Okay, let's scale up. Let's see what has to happen next, okay? We're going to use these tools of cadence and synchronization to help us scale up. We're going to use cadence to make things, to turn unpredictable events into planned events. One of our cadence-based activities in the Scaled Agile framework is called PSI or release planning. It's called release planning, and may or may not be planning a release. You're just planning the next increment of software. We use cadence to do that. Synchronization is different. Synchronization causes multiple events to happen at the same time. Some of those events might be, let's realign the vision based upon the fact pattern. Some of that event might be, let's integrate the software code into a blob and see if we can get some feedback from the customers whether it's any good or not, right? With synchronization, I get regular system-wide integration, higher fidelity tests. Objective assessment. Sync events facilitate cross-functional trade-offs of resources. We just had a sync event, evaluated the code, looked at the backlog, looked at the velocity, and that team is underwater. They're a nasty bottleneck. I can do something about it. It was true when I didn't have the discovery. Now I actually have the discovery and I can take action. So cadence and synchronization are a watchword. Absolutely kind of lean mantra. We saw a mantra earlier. I forget what it was, or maybe it was yesterday. I don't remember where I saw the last mantra. Was there a mantra this morning? Didn't you have a slide that had a mantra on it? Were any of you here? Okay. Don't care. Maybe it was me. Okay. Let's take it to the program level, but now we need different people. We need different roles, and we need help from different sorts. Are there any system architects in this room? Please say yes. Okay. And your role on an Agile team is what? Something. I remember I was in London not too long ago giving a version of this talk, and a system architect stood up in the Q&A and he said, you know, one of the things I don't like about this Agile model is we're not part of the team. Do you think that hurt his feelings? Do you think that scales? Well, they can't be part of that team. That's too small a team. That's an empowered team. They're fully capable of managing their stuff. But who's going to help us bring all that stuff together? I'm pointing as if this actually did anything. That makes me feel good to wave my arm. There's no actually impact up there, but that won't stop me. Right? Now, all of a sudden, if I program level, I take 5 to 10 teams. Let's say they're really good and they're really empowered and they cut a ton of code and they use XP practices and the design emerges. How does their vision get stitched together architecturally? How do they make a decision about which app server they're going to deploy or which version of single sign-on? Are they going to use SAML-based open source or Ping Identity or whatever? How do those decisions get made? And would it be convenient if all of my teams used a different single sign-on mechanism for maintenance purposes? Of course not. Would it be convenient if they all locally optimized their databases? No. Come on. We've got to have some governance and some guidance for that, and we need roles and people to do that. So we want them aligned to a common mission, and now we change the rules a little bit. That two-week sprint is actually really fast, and it's too fast at the next level of abstraction, right? You need a little more time because I want to get my key stakeholders to get feedback, and they may be directors or VPs or outside the company. So we'll deliver fully tested system-level solutions every 8 to 12 weeks, very common. So what you see here is a fractal, right? There's a behavior at the program level that parallels the geometry and the behavior at the team level. The big stuff, we can't really plan that every 2 weeks. It's too big, right? But every 8 to 10 or 12 weeks, we could plan that. And we'd love to have system integration every hour and every day and every minute, but we probably have some issues. We probably have some incompatibilities in our CM environments, and there's different between here and Beijing or some of your supporting sites. And they have to have common sprint lengths, because if one team is running 3 weeks and one team is running 4 weeks and one is running 2 weeks, what is the time in which I can bring those synchronized end sprints together? You can do this, I'm sure. Yeah. Every 12 weeks, worst case. So we just make all sprint lengths are 2 weeks, right? Some teams struggle with that because Scrum started out with longer sprints, 30-day sprints. The easiest way to get a team from 3 weeks to 2 week sprints is to have them run 1 week sprints. And they'll be so much better. 3 week sprints, and that actually hit a hot button for me, are my least favorite sprint length. And the reason is that what happens in the third week in a 3 week sprint? All the integration and testing that should have been happening before. So, you know, test manager told me one time, Dean, you idiot, we can't possibly go to 2 week sprints because as it is, we only have that last week to do all our testing. Right? So we switched them to 2 weeks because it's actually really hard to figure out when to start testing. Is it like Thursday, the second Thursday at 10 a.m. we're supposed to start testing or what? So it's like, well, shoot, we just start testing from the beginning because it'd be easier that way. So 3 weeks is not my favorite. Also changed the language a bit. And here's where I did take a diversion from kind of Scrum 101 and the Scrum rollouts. I actually hung around with product managers. I ran product management at Rational. Admittedly, product management in the software companies is a relatively late event. Maybe not so much here. We stole this product management function from the consumer products companies. I respect product managers. I think they know what they're doing. I don't think teaching them a user story is really that valuable. It's kind of like teaching a pig to sing, you know. It doesn't sing very well and annoys the pig. And they know what their features and benefits are. They've been taught that way. So at this next level of the framework, what you see is we support that. So the thing above the thing above a story is not an epic, it's a feature. It's a feature that has business value that you can speak to and you can describe to me or somebody else. And I want to have a slightly deeper topic here. So I'm going to take a deep dive because it is so important. And the stuff is on the web. So the good news is this will be recorded. But more importantly, there are full write-ups of the stuff on the web. And this is how do you prioritize work. Lean prioritizes work fundamentally different than any other model. Lean assumes that there's a backlog and that flow is achievable. Lean assumes that there's more than enough work to do. So I'm not out trying to evaluate opportunity A and opportunity B in the various market. I'm really looking at the stuff in my backlog. How many teams here look at their backlog and say, hey, we got more than enough work to do, right? Most everybody. So if that's your paradigm, it's actually simpler in a way to think through sequencing. So what, and this comes from Reinertsen's work, which is I think the smartest work around about prioritization. And he describes basically you've got to know two things to know how to prioritize your work. You've got to know what is the cost of delay in delivering value. And the cost of delay is a funny number. It's an aggregation of stuff, including are we going to get a penalty? Are we going to lose market share? Is my boss going to get mad at me? I'm not going to get that revenue to make the quarterly number, et cetera. And then what's the cost to implement the value thing? Okay? And he says, if you only quantify one thing, quantify the cost of delay. So it's funny words, but it's good words because they're not overloaded with everything else. They're not overloaded with minimum marketable features or exciters and delighters or any of the other stuff. And while I won't go here in any depth at all, what Lean teaches you is that effective job sequencing produces better end ROI than simply lining up individual job ROI and pushing it through the system. And the reason is that big jobs clog the system. And they may have a good ROI, but they prevent all the other little ROIs from going out with it. So the net accumulation of return over time is lower sometimes by starting large, high priority, high value jobs than it is finding small jobs that go through the system. Now, Agile teaches us something about big jobs. What do you do if you get a big job? Break it down. Smaller job. If story doesn't fit in the sprint, what do you do?
Split it.
If you're not framework followers, some are. If a feature doesn't fit in a PSI, what do you do? Split it. Okay? So we know how to break these things down. And the net result of that is this formulation, which I'll leave as a pointer. It's been extremely well-received and vetted and great, which is that the best prioritization scheme is called weighted shortest job first. And what that means is it's the job that has the best ROI that I can deliver the most quickly, right? So it's a ratio of cost of delay divided by job size or job length, depending. So we use that formulation, and we compare those things. And I guess I do have a little bit more here. Cost of delay is a combination of user, business value, time value, and risk reduction, opportunity, enablement value. Notice how nicely that text popped out of that box on me in the conversion of some kind. So if you can now, you don't have to do absolute numbers. What do you think about being asked to say, how much more of foo are we going to sell if I put this feature in? Who knows? But if you ask a customer, would you prefer this one or this one? Easy conversation, right? So you can use your agile relative estimating skills to save your bacon here. Go through your big backlog, compare these things, which has the highest user value, which has the value that changes most quickly over time. Oops, I'm hitting a deadline. I'm hitting a tax filing deadline or another compliance deadline. And then what does this job do for me? You put those on the numerator, you divide by the job size, and you have forced rank prioritization called weighted shortest job first. Not a trivial thought, not a trivial discussion. Well documented on the web, well documented in Reinertsen's work, and one of our strongest suggestions, which is to start thinking about approaching your job from weighted shortest job first by understanding the cost of delay. All the way back to principle number one, take an economic view. This is the way we take an economic view, is we take a systematic approach. We only have to use relative estimating, which is great. Even job size doesn't have to be absolute. Well, this is twice as big. Okay, this one has four times the risk reduction value. He wins. Very, very simple matrix formulation built into that. I got Reinertsen's book in 2009. I was in Munich. My wife was supposed to join me for a long weekend. I'd been traveling a while. Too long, and was anxious to have her come over. And we had a pipe break in our house in Boulder, Colorado, and we have hardwood floors. Has anybody ever mixed water and hardwood floors? This is not a good plan. So my wife called me and said, I'm not coming. And I certainly understood that. You know, she had her priorities, and it was pretty depressing. So I had Reinertsen's book with me. I hate to say that saved me for the long three-day weekend, but it did. I read it in 3 days straight. I got up in the middle of the night writing out Little's Law, you know, trying to understand it and practice. I went to Starbucks the next day, and I took my iPhone timer to try to understand queuing theory. Because if you don't understand queuing theory, you don't understand the way work flows. And queuing theory is quintessential and lean. Rule number one, long queues are all bad. If we go to a lunch and there's a long queue, how do you feel about it?
Annoying.
Crappy, right? If you go to the bathroom and there's a long queue, how do you feel about it? Name a long queue you're thrilled to go be a part of. They're all bad. Long software queues are also all bad. Longer cycle times, right? So what's the Little's Law say, that little formulation in the middle? It says the average wait time is equal to the length of the queue divided by the average processing rate in the queue. And that's what I was doing. I was just trying to prove that law at Starbucks. And the line got really long, and after a while, here's what happened. So as long as line was 8 or 10 people, people would walk right in and continue their conversations and order their stuff. As soon as it got to 10 or 12, people would walk right in, stop, look at the line, and then they'd step back out on the street for a second. What were they doing? Pardon? Looking for alternatives. They were looking for a shorter queue. If you have long queues that you're very proud of, boss, we've got all this stuff we have to do. We've got a year's worth of work. They may be looking around you, right? I need to find somebody with a shorter queue. And by the way, this isn't bad performance. This is just math. If you have a long queue of work, you're going to be slow. Here's a new thing. In the back of your long queue, you're slow, period. Slow is twice as long, you're twice as slow. Now, there's a difference between a backlog and a queue. Can anybody name one? What's the difference between a backlog, a scrum backlog, and a queue?
Don't have to do it
all, right? And you can jump the queue in a backlog. You can't jump the queue at Starbucks. You can, but you gotta take some social risk with that, okay? But if your backlog is there and it's socialized, and if your backlog is committed, it is a queue. It's an unavoidable conclusion. You're going to have to do all of those things, and you are therefore slow. So the fastest way to increase your throughput is to decrease your queue size. Dump some lower prioritized jobs. Dump some lower priorities or whatever. But keep in mind that you will be no faster than that. And that particularly matters at the program backlog level, which is where this slide is inconveniently tied to two slides back, right? This is where the economics happens. The team's prioritization, a team in an agile program that has, you know, maybe 8 or 10 teams on it, a team's prioritization has less economic impact than the program prioritization. The program prioritization drives all that economics. So teams will naturally sequence during kind of release planning. We plan typically 4 or 5 sprints at a time in release planning. They'll naturally sequence the jobs and it makes sense, but the priority is set when it comes in. That comes from product management. Let's stay lean. Architecture. System architects here, please. Great, we need you. Okay. Somebody has to be thinking about how this system works at a level of abstraction where you can see it all. Right? Architecture is basically take away all the stuff in the system that you don't need to explain how it works, and what you have left is the architecture, right? That's all I need to explain what it works. We need those people, but we don't need them the old way. We don't need my well-formed UM model be handed off from the silo of the architects to the silo of development teams and say, build it that way. And then the development team's holding the bag, because then when it doesn't work, they're going, well, of course it doesn't work. We told the architect it wouldn't do it. And the architects are going, well, it's an idiot team. We told them to do it that way, and it's an idiot team. And nothing. Everybody's pointing fingers, nothing works. So design emerges, architecture is a collaboration. I can't go into these in much detail, but I'll point you to them. And there is just Monday morning, yesterday, we pushed a new white paper on this topic to guidance on the Scaled Agile Framework. A few keys in here. When in doubt, code or model it out. Why are we arguing? We're fast. We run short sprints. We have design spikes. Let's code it up. Let's try to. Let's do objective evidence. They build it. They test it. What do you mean by that? Hey, I got this cool idea for single sign-on. We're going to use Ping Identity, which you really should use Ping Identity. I know that Microsoft has their own answer in that space, but Ping Identity's got great single sign-on software. We're going to use Ping Identity, and here's the way you're going to deploy it. Ask that same architect. Once that's deployed, how would we know if it fails to work? Customers will call. Yeah, but that's not the answer I was looking for, right? If you're the architect, sir, you got to help us understand how this thing is going to be tested. What kind of test automation, test infrastructure is there? And because you're an architect and you have a purview over a larger number of teams, you can start to see some common threads and some common patterns and some common testing and testing automation tools that you can use to help do that. Emergent design, right? Right back to Reinertsen, the principal peer-level coordination, tactical coordination should be local. What's more tactical than figuring out the design at the team level, right? So stories in a team backlog create a pull for emergent design. But emergent design isn't enough. I can't have 10 or 20 teams or 100 teams in some cases collaborating on a system where the design is simply a bottom-up compilation of the things they thought were the cool way to implement it, right? I have to have some intentional architecture on top of that. And I need that because I have to build substantial runway. Now, if you're operating on an 8 to 10 week kind of timeline, which you might be if you adopt the framework, you're going to discover that it's very, very risky to do substantial architectural rototilling in an 8 week period when you're also going to lay in new features and deliver those features in a valuable format. It's too much risk. So basically says, I've got to have some runway in front of me. I got to have a little bit of architecture. If I want to land that next PSI, all the technical infrastructure that I need in order to be able to do that has to be there when I start that. So it's got to kind of start ahead. I can't have solely emergent design. And what we have here is this kind of balance in the middle where we have system architect and an enterprise architect in some cases at the top of the stake. And there's intentional architecture, and that constrains emergent design. And emergent design tries feedback into intentional architecture, says, no, you can't do that either. And that's where we get the ideas. And that's why that says architecture is a role collaboration, right? Architecture is not a given, it's not a handoff. Architecture is a role collaboration. Design emerges, architecture is a role collaboration, and that's the way we want to make that work. And this Kanban system was developed for a company in Finland, a company called F-Secure, that had some absolutely brilliant people, including their CTO, one of the brightest guys I've ever worked with, in most every way but one. And the way that failed was that he did great PowerPoint, and he could predict and describe the way the system needs to evolve, and he was largely right. It did need to evolve that way. But what he did was he made one mistake. He said that this is important and this can be done by about then. The by about then was almost a death knell to the company because he had no idea of the capacity of the team. He didn't understand their current context, that some of those teams were just fighting for their very lives in the marketplace. They had essentially no capacity to think about new things. They could barely keep up with the old stuff. So we invented this architectural-based Kanban system so that you can see this stuff. You can reason about it. You can see it in the backlog. Work in process limits, how come? The more things the architect is working on, the more expectations the stakeholders that the architect is working with for what they're going to get are, right? It's just a fact. I'm working on it. What's that mean? I'm going to get it. So limit that too in the same way. Put work in process limits there. I won't go any deeper on that. And lastly, we go to the portfolio level where basically the real economics come from. And there we want to come back to our lean principles and talk about those. And we talk about centralizing strategy and decentralized execution and local decision making. We want to talk about having our investments work in such a way that they're consistent with the architecture that we need to support it. And a business epic Kanban system provides visibility and work in process limits to support the big stuff from the big business needs. So now at the top of the framework, you see two Kanbans up there. Well, you don't, but I'm pointing to them. I'll pretend. The red one is the architecture Kanban. That just says this. You would be telling me all the items that are in work in process, to what extent they're elaborated, have been estimated or not, what's the business case, or really going to do this or not. And the business people would have one too. Why are they not just one big Kanban system? Because people don't spend enough time together. Right, come from different universes. That's somebody running Clarity versus somebody doing modeling. And we want objective metrics to support governance and Kaizen as well. And we have to move from a set of legacy mindsets that you see on the left here, centralized control, project overload, detailed project plans, centralized annual planning, work breakdown structures, project-based funding, projects in PMBOK, waterfall, milestones. put a stake through the heart, all that stuff. But when you do that, recognize that strategy and investment funding, governance and program management are real functions in the enterprise. They can be done badly, the same way that we can write some crappy code or have bad HR policies. But strategy and investment funding has to happen. It's not arguable, right? Program management is going to happen too, because A, these self-managing programs can't manage their own interstitial spaces with the other programs, and B, it's good if they have a common framework, a common way to approach reporting, et cetera. And then lastly, governance. People don't like that word very much, but you know what governance is? It's feedback. It's controls. So the teams sprint and they get feedback. The programs have big PSIs and they get feedback. Well, we got to have feedback at this level as well. But we need to move from our legacy mindsets of, you know, we put it all in Bandiv, and if there's a $70,000 project, you come back with your tin cup and you beg for it. And we got too many projects in the mix, but that's okay because we're getting our utilizations way up now, right? We'll drive those utilizations up. We can plan all this stuff. And we did the work breakdown structure to the lowest leaf node. So before you've started anything, we bid the smallest thing on the bottom of the leaf. And you need a new project, come get more money. You get the idea. And waterfall milestones, we got to move to a new model. And this is an important slide as well, because this can break the bottleneck and the problem that we have in basically the whole funding model. And what this slide predicts basically is that once you just determine what an agile program is, and that's an experiment, once you determine here's what an agile program is, you allocate its funding for some period of time, 6 months, maybe a year. And then all the decision making is made there. I don't need portfolio or PMO support for making decisions if I've decided that value stream there, that number one, is there. What I do need support for is the things that are still centralized, the cross-cutting epics, the places where I have to make interconnections. I don't have good examples in your world, but you know, in the mobile world, the places where all of a sudden I need to upload a photo to Facebook with a single click. That's a cross-cutting epic. That's going to affect lots and lots of people. It's going to affect the communication teams, the photo teams, the Facebook application team, et cetera. So we want the funding to be established in big numbers to drive the trains, and then we want the portfolio backlog to really only worry about the cross-cutting stuff that comes next. Centralizing strategy, decentralizing implementation and strategy. And lastly, the one I skipped, there's a huge difference between Agile and Lean. And I got most of my epiphanies. I've been fortunate to be part of some very, very large and very successful Agile programs that have produced results that we would not have anticipated. I would not have believed that you could see a 30 to 50% increase in quality in a company that's been in the market already for 100 years, or a 50% increase in productivity. I wouldn't have ever advertised that, but that's what you get. And when you get that, people like working there better because it's more fun. But I learned most of what I learned in large failed program, and that was a traditional program where we rolled out Scrum. And everybody know the chicken and pig story in Scrum? Yeah. Who's the chicken? Who's the chicken? Management, right? Impediments. They're not the people who remove impediments. They're impediments because they don't get this model. So we went through and we trained all the development teams and taught them this new model, and we didn't train their managers. That's not what you do in Lean. If that same company, if they did a Lean transformation, they would go in and they would do Lean boot camp for all the managers. They'd take them away for how long? You know how long it takes to kind of get inculcated in Lean? How long these boot camps run? Minimum of 2 weeks, more typically 6. Then those people become the trainers for the Lean implementation. They then go to the floor and say, I'm the leader. I have this responsibility. I'm a Lean thinking manager's teachers. How much Agile and Scrum have we taught your managers? How much have they taught themselves? Lots, little?
Zero.
If they don't know what this model is, how is that going to scale? It doesn't scale. We don't do that anymore, right? When we're involved in transformation, everybody is involved, and we want the managers to lead. Teach them to coach. Teach them to ask with powerful questions. Teach them to be mentors. Teach them Kaizen events. Teach them how to run a good inspect and adapt workshop. Get them on board, right? They develop the people. They'll do the product. They understand and teach lean and agile behaviors. They're trained in the practices and tools of continuous improvement. They take responsibility for success. There was that thing that was a nice little epiphany inside XP where I was talking to Dave and said, well, how do we know what happens with this story? And he says, well, during planning, one of us will take responsibility for the story. And he says, what's that mean? He says, well, once I've said that, I own that. It's my personal responsibility to deliver that into the baseline with quality. I own that. That's my problem. Right, so what we do in the industry right now is we take that metaphor one step up, which is the responsibility for lean, agile, enterprise success rests with you folks, rests with managers and directors. And you, in order to do that, you've got to educate yourself. You've got to understand what it is. You can't be the person that didn't go to the Scrum class and move forward from there. So just a few ideas in that regard. Form and support a lean, agile working group in your department or your division. Have management in it. Create and work the transformation backlog. Read Principles of Product and Flow, Agile Software Requirements. It's free here today. A Lean Software Development from the Papandikes. Because the foundation of Lean is leadership, and therefore the foundation of SAFe, a Scaled Agile Framework, that's you. It's your job. It's to understand what can be done and take responsibility to get the benefits that these techniques have delivered. Okay, I'm right at the cutoff with time for a couple questions.
Actually, can you handle them on the break, and then you're going to be at the expo reception tonight?
I can do anything that's convenient for you, Mr. Maitre D.
Mr. Guy with the mic. I think we should do the questions offline.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you very much,
Dave. Yep, thanks.
Now, one quick thing before we go into the breakouts. Some of you this morning were able to get your evaluation forms when you checked in, and some didn't have them. Very strongly encourage you to go by the registration desk and grab an evaluation form. That is our number one, almost exclusive, mechanism of getting good feedback, and we really appreciate that. The sooner you get it, the more you're not going to confuse Dean with Jason and go, one guy was great and the other guy, that's right. Don't want to do that. All right, let's take about a 13-14 minute break and then reconvene in the tracks. Thank you.